classroom classes. Many of you know, and I would suggest here, the theme of this year's adult ed was classroom. So we have many different events, many different classes that are offered in the classroom theme, and we partnered with the OU on a variety of different topics. And tonight, we're going to be here to share and has expertise in this particular area.
But if you do that, that's going to mess you up.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So we'll show off the lights. You probably won't be able to see us very well.
So you just, you just scroll through the slides one by one.
No problem.
So what we'll do is, Rabbi Sherlock, because this presentation, if there's any questions, whoever has a question, just come on up and come right over here, because this is also the microphone. So the camera's the microphone. They'll be able to hear you if you're sitting right about here. So without further ado, Rabbi Sherlock.
Scott, Good evening. Sorry I can't be there with you, but I guess the next best thing is to be sitting at my living room and my dining room table and talking to you on my computer. Just as an introduction, as Howie said, and I want to thank Howie for his efforts in bringing this. And I changed on him mid-course this morning, going from Skype to Google Hangout, and Howie adjusted without a problem. So I want to thank him for his efforts. What I do in the OU is I take care of the restaurants and the caterers in the OU. And that gives me an insight into why the topic is called the ABCs of Eating Out. One of the things that Jews love to do, just look at the lovely sushi everyone was offering me through the internet. All right, Jews love to eat. But the Jews have a responsibility to be careful what they eat. And as we read in this past week's Parsha and Parsha Shemini, in the last part of the Parsha, we read all about the different kosher animals, non-kosher animals. The Torah tells us an important lesson, which I heard from my rabbi this Shabbos. Right, he says, "Ki ani Hashem amales chamer tzitzrayim," that God elevated us and took us out of Egypt. Rashi says on that pasuk that the purpose of taking Klal Yisrael out of Egypt was in order to give them that they should not eat machalos asuros, they should not eat the forbidden foods. There are many reasons why we could have been taken out of Egypt. What is so important about about not eating the non-kosher food? So many commentaries explain, as the Torah continues, "Vizkadishtem yisem kedoshim," that eating food is not a means to an end, but rather the way we sanctify ourselves is by eating so we can better serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when it comes to making our decisions about what we're going to eat, it's not just which restaurant we're going to choose tonight or which sushi place we're going to eat tonight, but rather that by making brachos when we eat and making a bracha achrona after we eat and eating so we can make sure that we come to shul and we come to the services and we take care of all of our other mitzvos that we're required to do, makes the food that we're eating not just a means to an end, but a means to better serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So for the most part, I'm going to try to be practical, even though giving many examples, and this is the next minute or two is my only real Torah content, even though there will be many examples that are brought, but I try to bring everything down to the practical aspect of it. There are two approaches where one can have to providing certification. And if anyone has ever read a haskama, an approbation that's given to a sefer, you read in the two different types of approbations. One who writes that this wonderful, great person went ahead and wrote this sefer, and he would never write something that would not be exact and proper, right? So I therefore give you this approbation. However, then there's those rare people like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and others who write that this great person wrote a sefer, and I reviewed the sefer from cover to cover, and I have comments on page 83 and page 97 and page 111 that I disagree with the author, but otherwise the sefer is a very good sefer. The difference is, as many of the rabbis in my office have told me through the years, is the difference between giving a haskama, giving an approbation, and giving hashgacha and providing certification. Providing certification means that we're verifying what's going on and what's happening. And if we're, to use what they call a brisker chakira, right, an analysis based on the brisker way of learning, it's the difference between what they call a cheftza and a gavra. Those who are taking the approbation, the haskama approach, are saying that this great person it will never serve me non-kosher food, and therefore I trust him. Whereas the OU takes the approach of we're giving a certification on the cheftza, on the actual person, on the actual food that we're certifying, and we try to verify independently that which is going on is done properly and is presented properly. And from that perspective, I want to talk about five different areas that you'll see are relevant, you know, that come on page one. I'm not going to go through the Hebrew of the Mar Makomos, but just give some of the relevant halachos so we can see how they manifest themselves in the day-to-day food service that exists, as you see on page two of your handout, right? What to ask about a restaurant and sound intelligent. I'm at a wedding at a hotel. What does a mashgiach have to watch for? And at a kiddush on Shabbos, you know, what do I have to be concerned with? Each one of these areas is something that happens to us on a daily, a weekly basis. And these five halachos and many others are can be relevant in each one of these areas. So let's go through them one by one, and hopefully we'll leave some time for questions at the end of the talk. The first one is that of bishul akum, right? Food that's cooked by a non-Jew. Right? There are two conditions that halacha requires that in order to prevent intermarriage, our rabbis decreed that food that was cooked by a non-Jew, that the one of the ways where Jews and unfortunately non-Jews come together is through significant foods. Right? Not, you know, if you have a cup of water together, if you have a cup of coffee together, maybe not, but if you have a serious meal with someone, that could lead to what they call kiruv levavos, just as many of our kiruv organizations use food as a way to get to the hearts of the youth who they bring closer to Judaism. So too, these foods could also bring through kiruv levavos of people coming together. So Chazal decreed that there are two conditions that one has to be aware of before they determine if something will fall into the category of bishul akum. One is something that's not eaten raw, right? So for example, if you have apples or carrots or peppers, right? If a non-Jew would go ahead and cook an apple or pepper and or a carrot, provided that it was done in kosher equipment, and we'll talk about that as we go along, that even though the non-Jew cooked it, it would not fall in the category of bishul akum. However, if you have eggs or meat or potatoes, or since everyone was eating sushi, fish, right? If that was cooked by a non-Jew, that would fall in the category of bishul akum, and therefore any of those foods that are being cooked, one has to be sure that a Jewish person had a hand in the cooking. And for our Sephardic brethren, not only that they had a hand in the cooking, but they had it in the actual cooking process, not only of turning on the fires, which we'll see as we go along. The second condition is that of that it's something that's nechal shulchan malachim, that's something that it's food that is served at a state dinner or a state breakfast, right? As you have steak or rice. So when you come to sushi, if you're talking about the fish, and you're talking about the rice, if a non, you know, what could be in a sushi place, right? Just the rice. If the rice was cooked by a non-Jew, we already have an issue to eat the sushi. The next issue is that, you know, in a restaurant, you have to deal with who's turning on the fires. Is there a, you know, in the OU food service and all of our restaurants and caterers, we have a mashgiach tamidi who's responsible for turning on all the fires. But, you know, in a local situation, you may not be able to have a full-time mashgiach. Who is the one who's responsible for turning on the fires? Or maybe you're relying on the pilot lights, and some of the Mar Makomos talk about what many refer to the heter of the Ramah, that allow one to rely, if the pilot light was lit by a Jew, for that to be obviate the concern of Bishul Akum. But in many homes today, there's another concern. Baruch Hashem, you know, many families have a dual-income family where the husband and wife are both working, and they may have someone at home taking care of the children. Right? And many times I've heard people tell me, "Oh, my babysitter makes the food in the house." Right? That's also a concern. You know, I think it was President Reagan who abolished having pilot lights in the ovens, in the consumer ovens. And therefore, once the pilot lights are no longer there, someone has to be involved in the cooking process, and that can be an issue even in everyone's home. The second item we'll discuss in the Maariv Mekomos talks about the segregation of meat and fish. When it comes to separating meat and fish, Chazal tell us chamira sakanta meisura, that something that's a matter of isur, of danger, which the Shulchan Aruch writes, eating meat and fish is considered something dangerous, is sometimes more stringent than that which is prohibited. These can have many different practical ramifications. One is, I may not pronounce this correctly, but someone could help me with the pronunciation. There's a certain sauce they make that uses anchovies. It's called, thank you, Gesundheit. Whatever you'd like to, Worcestershire sauce, whatever it's called, right? But if that has fish in it, right, one is not allowed to go ahead and serve and use that sauce on his meat, on his chicken, right? So sometimes if you look in the market, you can find three of those sauces on your shelf. Two of them are going to have an OU fish, and one of them is just going to have an OU plain. But if you look in the ingredients, all three of them may have anchovies. I've actually seen a number of the restaurants. There are a couple of companies that actually make this sauce without anchovies, and it's actually parv. But the OU position is that if the fish component in this sauce is less than 1/60th, then the OU considers the sakana, the danger, not to be there because it's so statistically insignificant and halakhically insignificant. So the one that's parv, you can actually, even though there's technically fish in there, you would be allowed to put on your meat. A second question that comes up with the segregation of meat and fish is many restaurants sell fish and chips, right? Fish and French fries. But if they're frying the French fries in the same oil that they're frying their chicken nuggets, then that oil is not just oil, you know, is fleishik oil. And if the oil is actually meat, then those French fries are not just made in meat equipment, but are actually fleishik of French fries, and therefore cannot be served with fish. Another example, which I get sometimes in our delis, right? Someone comes and wants to order a pastrami sandwich with tuna. Now, that may, to all of us, may sound a little bit revolting or, you know, not so tasty. But many of our restaurants, especially in the New York area, a large portion of their sales are to non-Jews, and they don't know from this. But we would tell our restaurant that they can put it on a separate plate. You can order some pastrami, you can order too. What he does with it, it doesn't prohibit the equipment that it was served on, right? And they put it in the dishwasher and it could be washed, but they're not supposed to be served on the same plate. Another example is at a wedding, at some of the fancier simchas, they French serve the food. So they take the same spoons or tongs to serve the meat and the potatoes and the green beans, right? And if they using those same utensils to give you the green beans and the meat and then put the fish, you can't eat that fish with the same forks and spoons that are serving meat, because they literally have residue of meat on them. The next example is that what's called, anyone who's ever ordered out from a kosher restaurant knows what they call shiluach al yidei akum, right? The food that was sent by a non-Jew, one has to be very careful to be certain that the food is properly sealed. A subcategory of this halacha is what's called basar shenisalim in ayin. All right, it's meat that disappeared from the eye. So when a restaurant closes at night, right, one has to be sure that all meat, fish, poultry, and cheese is properly sealed or locked. And even in the takeout store, if they leave some of the things in the case in the supermarket, they have a case with all the salads and all the meats and the deli, right? That has to be locked at night, because if someone can access it, they could potentially switch what's in there. The next example is that of what we call in halacha nat bar nat, which is what we would colloquially refer to as DE, right? Dairy equipment. I would think, the OU has a kashrus hotline where, the rabbi answers, around 500 questions a week. Among those questions, about 250 of them are Oreo questions, asking whether Oreos are dairy or dairy equipment, and these are, on the occasions that I answer the phone, it's amazing when there are two types of Oreos that are actually dairy equipment, how people start the phone call with, "I know all the Oreos are parv. Are the Reese's Pieces ones also parv?" And you have to clarify that's dairy equipment. What does it mean, dairy equipment? Dairy equipment could mean that they're producing one product one after the other, not even cleaning out the equipment. It could be that they're cleaning out the equipment but not kashering it. Or it could mean that they're cleaning out and even boiling out the equipment, but not at a high enough temperature to be considered the next product to be considered parv. Some of the classic examples of this are our Oreos. Haagen-Dazs sorbets are something that's also OUD, but is also made on dairy equipment. But I'm always concerned when someone calls and asks, "Is this DE?" Because once a company, the OU does not have this DE designation. It's either OUD or it's OU Parv. There's nothing in between. But if a consumer calls to find out if something is dairy equipment, the company that's producing this product already has some type of dairy in the facility, and they don't want to have to kasher in between and have a mashgiach coming back. So they just label everything dairy. So if they would reformulate their product, they would not necessarily have to be informing the OU, because if the ingredients are already in the facility and are approved, and they reformulate it to something dairy, so one has to be very careful. And that's why when someone would call the OU hotline to ask a question about dairy or meat, if something DE, they always finish the conversation with check back every few months to be sure that nothing has changed. Because really, if you ask me tonight if something is dairy equipment, and I tell you yes, in 2037, you're still eating that same cookie based on what I told you tonight in 2015. And therefore, one has to be very careful not to just make this assumption going forward. And another example is what we spoke about, the French fries that are made in the meat oil, right? That's literally meat and cannot be served with fish. Or a more classic question that comes up: I went into this restaurant and I only ate French fries. Do I have to wait 6 hours or however many hours, whether you're Dutch or you're German or whatever you are, however many hours you wait, do I have to wait that amount of time before I eat something dairy? The last example that we have on the Hebrew side of the page, it says, the halacha says that if one is serving parva milk with meat, one should have some type of heker, some type of recognizing symbol that the milk is actually parv. When we have such a situation, when a caterer is serving, even at a fancy dinner, we insist on them serving with portion-controlled coffee rich or cream or whatever it happens to be, assuming it's parv, and that's something one has to be very aware of, that there are many quote-unquote non-dairy creamers that are actually 100% dairy, that they're labeled OUD and they're not just dairy equipment, they are actually 100% dairy. The reason for that is the dairy farmers lobbied the USDA to say that this sodium caseinate, which is a derivative of lactose, which is a milk sugar, is not actual dairy, and therefore, and they prevailed, and therefore, it's able to be labeled non-dairy, whereas the halacha considers this 100% dairy. So one has to be very careful whether it's soy milk, right? Soy milk. I get the question all the time whether this soy milk, that soy milk is labeled D. It's kind of counterintuitive. I wouldn't think they want it to be dairy, right? If they're giving it for someone who's lactose intolerant of some sort. But nevertheless, it may be made on the same equipment that the milk is made, and they're not cleaning it out or kashering at a high enough temperature. But one has to be careful when you have a restaurant and they say, "Oh, I'm only serving the soy milk with the coffee." But at the same time, I know the chocolate cake that my wife makes for Shabbos also has soy milk in it. And that's, so there are some kugels that also have that recipe. If I'm going to eat that squash kugel with my chalent, right, at the same time, that's a problem because the halacha says that something that's made on dairy equipment can be eaten after meat, but cannot be eaten together with meat. So this issue of parva milk is something that one has to be very careful with as well. Now we're ready to with these few examples. Now we're ready to turn to the second page. And since the original conversation that I had with Howie was talking about the Shabbos catering, so we'll start with the bottom of the page first. And we'll go through each one of these things and explain how they're relevant both to Shabbos and to some of the examples we had given. But before we go, does anyone have any questions on what we've done until now?
Terry's question is, do you have to leave the 6 hours after the quote-unquote part of French fries?
If there's actual meat in there, the position of the OU would be that you would have to wait 6 hours. If you're making, one of the things that the many restaurants don't do, and we shouldn't delude ourselves into it, is they don't change the oil every time they make French fries. Right? We should be lucky that they change the oil every day or every week. Right, depending on what they're using. So that oil halachically is considered actual meat and has actual meat in it because they're not necessarily cleaning it out. And therefore, the halacha considers that oil to be fleishik oil, and one would have to wait 6 hours after that, after the french fries.
Wouldn't it be batel b'shishim then?
No, because the whole oil takes on a status of being fleishik. It's a good question, but that's not the case.
Good question. Why do we have in the Worcestershire sauce?
Right. So why is that 1/60th batel and the other one not? Because the company's not doing it for any technical purposes. The soy milk that's made on dairy equipment, the you would be now going ahead and doing this l'chatchila using this soy milk that's made on dairy equipment to cook your kugel that you're going to serve with fleishiks. Whereas the company is doing it for their own reasons, nothing to do with being mevatel Israel chatchila, nullifying the prohibition in the first instance. Anyone else? Okay, we go forward.
We can always come back to more questions about general kashrut.
Fine. So we'll try to leave room for questions at the end. Let's go ahead. We'll stop after Shabbos, after catering, and after restaurants, and after catering, and we'll give time for questions. The Shabbos kiddush. What do I need to be concerned with? All right, so the first thing it says, only dry, fully cooked food, such as kugel and meat, may be warmed up on Shabbos. All right, the halacha distinguishes between a davar yavesh and a davar lach, that which is solid and that which is liquid. And those are things that one has to be very careful with in determining what one is allowed to reheat or on Shabbos or to put into the Shabbos warmer before Shabbos. If anything is put into the warmer or whatever mode of heating that you're going to put in before Shabbos, so I've been to many kiddushim where they serve stuffed cabbage, where they served meatballs with sauce. They serve sweet and sour tongue. All of these things, but all of those things are put into the warmer or the Shabbos oven or whatever you're going to call it before Shabbos. To put that into the warmer on Shabbos morning will be an issue. All right. Number two, any visible liquid that is congealed from the food must be removed, and food should then be placed in a clean, dry pan before warming on Shabbos. If you're doing something like this at home and you want to have the chicken that you served Friday night on Shabbos morning, so you can't pour out the liquid, you have to take the chicken to put into a clean container, and the nominal liquid that might come back if you're reheating it in a permissible way on Shabbos is not considered a liquid. That's not what's called. But if you leave the much sauce that's left from your saucy chicken on Friday night, that's going to reheat and become a liquid, and a significant liquid on Shabbos. Number three is fully cooked dry food. Again, is just reiterating that issue. Can be warmed up in one of the following ways. All right, so in a catering situation is not the same thing as your home, but these would in theory be options if you had such things in your home. If you had a big pot that was filled with water and was heated before Shabbos, in fact, there were some caterers who would actually fill that bucket with ice before Shabbos and turn it on. So by the time it melts and Shabbos morning comes, you still have hot water. Because the hot water, if you put it on the fire is too high, will evaporate and you won't have any water left. All right, so you can put it on a pot and then a sheet pan above that pot, and then stack whatever you want above that. That pot has to be at least 8 inches above the blech. Again, that would have to be, the fire would have to be covered. The second option is what they have. There's a shelf in many, at least in the restaurants, and many people have a shelf above the stove. If you have a blech on the fire and the heat is going up, right, that could heat. And the third option, one has to be careful, is with a plata, what they call a plata, that some of the platas today get very, very, very hot, especially those from Israel. And one has to be careful not to, that it may burn your food, and that could be an issue on Shabbos. So those are three of the potential options for, as you see, a non-adjustable hot plate that is never used for cooking. Right? Some of those that get to a higher temperature might already be used for cooking. But it specifically has to be non-adjustable, so there can't be a chance that one would adjust it in case at 10 o'clock Shabbos morning, the food's not hot. So you gotta, do something. If you can't adjust it, it is what it is, and you're dealing with it. The next few items are important to discuss, right? For hot coffee and tea, right? So the OU doesn't allow tea bags in the kitchen on Shabbos, right? Because tea bags, the kli shlishi, not kli shlishi. The OU generally discourages, even though we allow the caterers to use it, to make tea scents, because depending on how many people the caterer has for Shabbos, if you imagine many Pesach programs, especially when Yontif was on Shabbos, right, they say the average amount of hot water needed is 7 cups per person for a Shabbos. If you imagine, so there are those who will have zero, there are those who are going to have 14, so that's how it evens out. But if you imagine 7 cups per person for a hotel with 1,000 people, that means you need to have the capacity to have 7,000 cups of hot water heated before Shabbos. Because at least the OU does not allow to use the system in the hotel where the water continues to feed in itself, even though one could make a case, the OU poskim are vehemently against it. One could make a case that if the non-Jewish waiter is taking the hot water, he has no intention. It's what's called a psik resha al yedei akum. It's a psik resha. Action A, even though it necessarily causes action B, because the non-Jew is doing action A, we don't worry about action B. But the OU would insist that the hotel have the capacity to have enough hot water for those 7,000 cups, right? Those 7,000 cups, you have to have some type of tea and coffee, etc., to be able to serve. So that's why we're going to say only instant tea and instant coffee are to be used on Shabbos, right? Instant tea is getting harder and harder to find. Many, many fewer companies are making it because of all the tea bags and the fancy teas. But what we know, it is still available, and one should be careful. The reason for instant tea, because the instant tea is already cooked, and we don't have to worry about the concern on the tea bags of what's called the kale habishul, that which is cooked so easily. Number five, wedges of lemon may not be used. All right, we have a prohibition on Shabbos of schita. You're not allowed to squeeze the lemon into the tea. There is actually a permissible way that one would be allowed to squeeze the lemon onto sugar, just as one would be allowed to squeeze lemon onto fish on Shabbos. But nevertheless, the OU does not allow the caterer to have wedges of lemon on the table. They say either the tea that you're serving should already have lemon in it, or you should have a bottle of lemon juice for those who want. Mm-hmm. The next one, number six, non-dairy creamer should only be served in the portion control sizes. Right? That we just explained that the chalav shkedim, that if there's parva milk, we want to be sure, especially in a hotel environment where there is milk very easily accessible, we want to be sure that the caterer didn't run out of non-dairy creamer. So he makes sure that on each one of those portion control things, it says it's parva milk and has an OU parv on it, and therefore we're allowed to use it. The last one is a. Hello?
Can you hear it?
I hear you. Can you hear me? I'm still here.
The image froze for a second.
Okay, I'm still here. Where should I go back to?
Non-dairy creamer.
Okay, so the non-dairy creamer, as we explained before, we have to be certain that it's actually parv, and therefore it has to be served in those portion control containers, as opposed to the little pitchers that you don't know what it is, and in a non-kosher environment or not a hotel environment where the milk is easily accessible, we have to be concerned that they might switch the milk for, and we need to be sure that it's actually parva milk. And finally, the loose powdered sweetened low and sugar. I remember when we brought this to Rav Shechter Shalita, he spent a Friday morning a few times trying to open the loose packets of sweetened low without breaking the letters. It's not an easy feat. And, they do make liquid drops of sweetened low or a sweetener in a loose powdered way. That's what we try to have our caterers use for Shabbos. Any questions about Shabbos?
Should we be serving non-dairy creamer in the mocha mix carton in our homes?
No. In your homes, I have to hope that if your husband's eating in your house, he trusts your kashrus at this point. So if that's the case, we're not concerned in your home, right? There's enough. There's just as Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, writes in a tshuva that he feels that the concern of Maris Ayin that someone might see by Shabbos clocks, right? When they first came out, Rav Moshe felt that if someone sees someone's light go on Shabbos, they're going to think they turned the Chas V'Shalom, the light on Shabbos. Right? Today, I don't think anyone who walks by a frum person's home and sees their lights going on and off on Shabbos are going to think that they actually, whether one of his kids or that they're going to assume it went on by a timer. So too today, if someone is serving parva milk in one's home, one does not have to serve it in the container, but one has to be very careful, as I explained earlier, with the non-dairy creamer to be sure that it's actually parv, because the D is not just dairy equipment. Any other?
Why doesn't
No, the Rabbi Ganak feels that many people don't understand what dairy equipment means. Just look for what happened with the Oreos, that everyone assumes that all the Oreos are parv after they learned that it's dairy equipment. Rabbi Ganak feels that if someone makes a mistake on D, that's one level. If someone makes a mistake on DE, and unfortunately, from the questions that the OU hotline gets, we see the kind of mistakes that people make, that the OU would rather people make a mistake and assume that it's dairy as opposed to the other way around. The one exception that the OU actually makes for on DE, and it doesn't say DE, is if anyone has any little children, they have the Isomil. The baby formula actually has an OU with an asterisk, an OU parv with an asterisk. It says, under the asterisk, made with parv ingredients on dairy equipment. The company petitioned the OU, if you will, that the non-Jewish consumer knows that OUD means dairy, and if their child is lactose intolerant, they would stay away from this their formula. And they said they, from their allergen concerns, they're not concerned with they're not concerned that they're going to have any problems, and they wanted to have it labeled OU parv. So that's the one exception that the OU made in those terms. Any further questions, or we can go on to our restaurants? Okay, so the first two, right? Who has the keys or access to keys to the refrigerators and freezers? And briefly describe the closing procedure for the kitchen, gas locks. We spoke about Basar Shina Salim and Ayin. We spoke about, you know, the locking the refrigerators and having protecting the integrity of the meat and all the food. And the next one, number three, is after the establishment closes at night, does the cleaning crew remain, or does a new cleaning crew come to clean the kitchen? All of these are referring to protecting the integrity. We've had situations where what happened when the cleaning crew is left at night by themselves and the equipment is not locked or protected from use. You have two guys there cleaning. They're hungry. They send one guy to McDonald's, come back with a burger, and then put the burger on the grill. And then they eat their sandwich, and you come in the morning. You don't know anything, and your grill is 100% not kosher. So we try to ascertain as to what the system of each local supervision is to protect the integrity of the equipment, of the refrigerator, so any meat, right? So it's not who has keys to the establishment. So you could have a situation where we have a restaurant who locks their gas every night, turns off the gas, locks all the refrigerators, but the owners have keys to the door. Or you could have a situation where the owners give up their key to the door and the mashgiach is the only one with a key. In which case, the refrigerators aren't locked and the gas is not locked and the store is not locked. And the store is the only thing that's locked. So just because you hear a certain answer does not necessarily mean that there's something wrong. You have to probe a little further. All right, the next is... Right. Are all pilot lights working properly? If not, what have you done about it? We spoke about bishulakum, about how the food is cooked. There are many different pieces of equipment in the restaurants. You know, the local VOD, the supervision has to be aware, or the consumer has to find out exactly what system they have in place. Are they relying on pilot lights? Do you want to rely on pilot lights? Do they have a convection oven? If the convection oven, every time it's open, it goes off. Right, one has to be either overrided or be sure the mashgiach is never too far away because he's the one who has to close the convection oven. Right, so one has to know, these procedures. Then please list the bedika. Sorry for that you don't recognize that word. Process used in the restaurant to check the vegetables. All right, everyone has their different opinion about how you check vegetables, how you wash vegetables. The OU has their opinion. You have to ask your Rav what, you know, or your local supervision what it is that you're doing and follow it. If you're not comfortable with the answer you hear, then you're not. But, you know, people call all the time and say, tell me about this restaurant. I said, what do you want to know? Right, it's kosher. The OU gives a hechsher. Okay, thank you. Have a good what are you asking? Right, you want to ask questions that are, you know, get to the point of the heart of the situation. Next. Right? Describe the way outgoing deliveries of orders are packed for delivery. Labels, staples. Right? You want to see how, you know, I have in front of me over here an OU tape, if you see. Right? You know, you want to see how it's taped. And you want to be sure that the tape is not going to be tampered with. One of the things that we often recommend to the restaurants is that over the tape, they staple the delivery over the tape. That's most restaurants today don't use those generic bills, but the bills are printed and they say the name of the restaurant, etc. on it. With that staple to the bill is an extra added security. All right. The next one, if you're speaking to the mashgiach, do you personally check in all incoming products? You're speaking to the owner. There's very easy. Many companies make products that are very similar sounding, but are not the exact same product, that are kosher or not kosher. Someone has to be taking specific responsibility for checking in all the products and being sure, you know, when they're getting from specific vendors, right? So they're getting the same thing all the time. But, you know, the biggest problems occur when they run out of something. So they send the guy to the supermarket. We tell our restaurants that when you're sending someone out to get something, you have to tell the mashgiach when you're going out to go get it, and you have to come back to him to show him so he can check. And it happens all the time, right? The mashed potato mix I had last year. You know, they sent the guy to the supermarket for the mashed potato mix, and he got six of them. Three of them were parv and three of them were dairy. Right, and Baruch Hashem, the mashgiach caught it before they used it. Right, that's something you have to be very careful when you're finding out about a restaurant, you're finding out about the kashrus. Be sure someone is taking responsibility, checking in all the products. Briefly describe the system of segregating meat and poultry from fish. Right, meat and fish can't be in the oven at the same time. They need to have separate cutting boards for meat and fish. Right, and even though they tell you, we don't want to chas v'shalom have any cross contamination and any problems, but you know what? The caterer and the restaurant and the chefs are only interested in doing something as fast as they possibly can, and not necessarily, you know, segregating the meat and fish. Number nine: for which items do you separate challah? Now, you know, there are many people who think that you only have to be mafresh challah on challah that you bake for Shabbos. But the halacha is if you use three pounds of flour on a cake, on cookies, on any other type of bread, that one is required to be mafresh challah without a bracha. If you use 5 pounds, you would be required to be mafresh challah. So one has to know if they're going to be, you know, is your bakery separating challah? Is your bakery not separating challah? Is your pizza shop that's making pizza, are they mafresh challah from every dough? Right? You have to be sure if it's owned by a Jew. If it's not owned by a Jew, then it's not. There's no requirement of challah. And finally, what system is used for checking eggs? Right, we have a minhag of the Ramah that says that one is required to check eggs for blood spots. We have different systems. Sometimes only the mashgiach checks it. Sometimes we designate a person to check, and we give him, you know, I guess inflation. When I started in the OU about 17 years ago, it was about $1 for a blood spot. Now it's in some places it's even up to $5. You give him, because for $2, he's not going to make himself crazy. For $5, he might already check, and he'll be happy to show to the rabbi. He might even carry some red nail polish with him to try and trick the rabbi into believing that there was a blood spot in like 12 eggs today and, you know, none tomorrow, you know. But you have to be, you know, that's why we write in our guidelines that the mashgiach will monitor the process. We generally tell them that we'll allow them to designate people to check the eggs, but they should check them in a clear container. So before they pour it in, the mashgiach will be able to look at the bottom of the container to see if, you know, quickly if there were any blood spots. There are many other things we could talk about restaurants, but let's stop there on restaurants, and we'll go on to our catering and conclude our talk. Any questions about my restaurants? The mitzvah is on the requirement of challah is on the one who is kneading the dough.
Right.
Right. So if the owner of the establishment is kneading the dough, if he buys already kneaded dough, if he buys the dough already made, he does not mafresh challah from the dough. But if he's making the batter from scratch, then it's his requirement to be mafrish challah. Mitzvah is on the owner, yeah. But then Isser is for you to eat. You're not allowed to eat challah bread or cookies that challah wasn't taken from. Hey, for the last part of our presentation, we call it at a wedding in a hotel. What does the mashgiach have to watch for? Now it's important to realize that different communities have different arrangements. In the New York area, we do not have any kosher kitchens in any kosher hotels. Every caterer comes in and kashers the kitchen every time he comes in, and therefore there are many issues that come up. The first issue is check all the waiters. They don't have any of their own utensils, their tongs. The waiters that are serving the simcha that you're going to at a hotel are not waiters that are brought into the hotel by the caterer, but rather are waiters that were brought into the hotel that work for the hotel. And they're hired by the hotel and they're responsible to the hotel. In fact, in some of the hotels, even if the mashgiach catches the waiter red-handed with doing something contrary to kosher protocol, he can't do anything to the waiter. And therefore, it's a major job for the mashgiach to be watching and checking and making sure that when he kashers, the same way we spoke earlier about the hotel, the caterer for Shabbos has to worry about 7 cups of hot water per person. The caterer in a hotel has to worry about 7 forks per person. So if you're doing an event for, you just keep adding the numbers. When you go from 500 to 700 to 800, you're going exponentially up the amount of forks. And the mashgiach has to be sure to check an extra few hundred forks to be sure that in any event they're not going to run out, because you don't want the waiter who knows exactly where the non-kosher silverware that the mashgiach is kashering to use for this event knows where the other stuff is. You want to make sure to make it as difficult or as unnecessary as possible for him to go take the non-kosher equipment. All right, the next one is properly sealed knives sent from the commissary to prevent the chef from using his own knives. And number 3, to monitor the carving station to be sure that he wasn't using his own knives. All right, the chef's, one of the things a chef likes is his knives. All right, if you just give him any knives, he'll tell you in a second, "Ah, this is worthless. This is dull. This is not." The chef's going to want to bring his own knives, and if you you see the chef wearing his nice long white coat and his apron around there, mashgiach has to. I know many rabbeim when I was growing up, they would check their students for tzitzis. They would give him a nice pat on the back in the morning to see if they're wearing tzitzis. Right, the mashgiach has to somewhat do something without hitting the chef to check that he doesn't hide his knife in his jacket or his coat. Especially on the carving station, when they're carving deli, that you have to be careful and be concerned that their specifications of how things are being cut are done properly. 4, the mashgiach turned on all the fires at the smorgasbord. I remember about many years ago, one of our caterers was doing the dinner for the community of Bet El in Israel, where they have a dinner for 1,500 people every year. And we were meeting with the caterer and the mashgiach who was going to be kashering. And the chef asked the mashgiach who lights the warmers that they keep the food warm for the smorgasbord. And the mashgiach responded to the chef, "You are." I said, "What? I thought the rabbi asked, to light the fire." So the mashgiach responded, "Every piece of food that's going into that warmer is already cooked. Something that's already cooked does not fall under the category of bishul akum if it's recooked by a non-Jew. But that's the warmer. There's the when they make eggs by a smorgasbord or by a bris, or when they're making crepes, which are also considered a concern of bishul akum. Or other types of foods that are being cooked at the smorgasbord, want us to be careful that the mashgiach is the one turning on the fires and taking care of that. Number 5, no fish and meat we're served in the same oven together. I think we've spoken about fish and meat enough there. But it's important to know that one of the things that the caterer is doing in the kitchen is they'll have separate trays of side dishes and fish that are served in a separate corner of the kitchen to be sure that the meat and the fish are not mingled together. Number seven, right? Separate utensils are available: tongs, knives, cutting boards, everything that's needed. Number seven, all margarine was examined for parva status, right? Very often when a caterer is going to make these fancy margarine patties or margarine rosettes and butter patties, we're going to make sure that they always make a different shape, right? Whatever the fancy shape they're going to make is going to be different for butter and for margarine, so we don't have any mix-ups. But you have to be careful, right? And sometimes you're going to find OUD margarine, which is actually dairy, not actually par. And the last two, right? Who is responsible for the bar? One of the biggest challenges in a hotel, we spoke about the waiters, is we feel like we're giving a free hashgacha to the bar. We don't certify the bar. They have to cut the lemons and make sure that they cut them with a kosher knife because of the lemons are a sharp food. Right? Mashgiach comes and makes sure he cuts enough lemon. Then you have to make sure that certain cranberry juices the OU doesn't accept, so they can't just serve the cranberry juice from their gun. No, that's coming from the bar. And all the drinks, right? Making sure that they're not using open bottles. We had once a certain catering establishment that was a non-kosher environment that really served a large kosher clientele. They were caught what they call marrying bottles, which means that they were serving, they had an event for 1,200, 1,300 people. It was a holiday party and for a low-end group of people. And they didn't want to serve the fancy stuff. So when one bottle was empty, they would pour the low quality stuff into the high quality bottles and bring it back out. And the mashgiach caught them, and they made major changes in the way the alcohol was served in this venue. But being certain that I'm going to make an editorial comment as to why we have to have a bar at all these events is a separate, it's not an OU comment, but it's something that we need to take stock of, because in many communities our children like to do better than we are, and when our children see us glorifying the alcohol that's served at these events, right, they take it a step further than we ever intended, and therefore one should think twice before getting involved in any of these, whether it's at the Shabbos Kiddush or at the restaurant or at the event. But that's my own personal comment, not necessarily do with it what you want. And finally, whose waiters are being used, right? It's very important to know, right, that very often if it's a hotel waiters are being used, we would insist on an extra mashgiach to be at the event to see that they're not taking the wrong things and not. And sometimes when it's a very big event, we'll have a mashgiach stationed by the non-kosher silverware as a policeman to be sure that they're not going and trying to sneak and take. And that's why we insist on the portion-controlled coffee rich or the creamer, because the waiters of the hotel know exactly where the milk is and where it's hidden, where they're going to go and where they're going to get it from. To take the wrong thing and put it in. Because, by the way, one of our mashgichim taught me that you know how you can tell the difference if it's milk or non-dairy creamer. He said if you pour a citrus drink into the milk, if it's milk, it's going to curdle. If it's not, it's not going to curdle. And that's how you can tell the difference. But just little PC, private investigative work within the conversation. So now I'm going to leave open for any questions related to what I spoke about, or if you have a kashrus question that I can answer, I'm happy to do it, and then we'll conclude with a few brief comments.
Oh, lights, register. Let me get the light.
Okay.
Just got lights. Okay, great. So anybody has a question, just come on up. Or you can save them there, and I'll repeat it.
Started, but if you have an old kind of old-fashioned kind of stove that has a pilot light,
as according to many poskim, if you turned on the pilot light and your non-Jewish domestic help turned the fire on from there, that would be okay. But you have to be aware that the non-Jewish domestic help could have in their cleaning could have knocked out the pilot light and relit the pilot light, and then you could have an issue. Next.
What would be the difference in the ways different kosher bodies require cooking of muskos? I can get Caesar salad with romaine, but you can't get that in Colorado.
There are different procedures. The OU is of the opinion that there's a statistically significant amount of since there are ladies in the crowd, I'll call it protein in the romaine lettuce, and therefore the halacha requires one to check it before its use, to wash it and check it. If you don't have a mashgiach in the establishment, you can't, since the non-Jewish help is not really caring about it, since the government allows these proteins at a very high level above the threshold requiring checking. Therefore, we cannot rely on them to be doing that. Hello?
Yeah, we're mulling over that. Why wouldn't the OU do education about Kli Sheni, Kli Shlishi for the Tiru, or is it just taking away the Tibet?
Because some of the Rabbanim in the OU are of the opinion that besides the concept of a Kli Shlishi, there has to be a difference between the way the tea is made on, or the coffee is made on Shabbos as opposed to during the week. And if the tea goes from the urn to the pitcher and the pitcher to the cup, your cup on Tuesday or Sunday night is a Kli Shlishi, then there's no difference the way you're making the tea on Friday night than you're making it on Tuesday night. And that's another concern that some of the poskim have. Right.
They don't have a heater in them, right? They're just insulated. They're just like a big.
Oh, it depends. In the homework, all of our shalom, besides the hot water that they, the hot water urns that they had a 500 gallon tank separate just for Shabbos to be sure that even over a 3-day yontiv they would have enough hot water. Right, so I don't think too many hotels have that. The Homuak did it for, because of the clientele they were serving. But most places, want to conserve. They have this inlet valve where every 10 cups you take, you get more water in there that you're going to never run out in the course of a 3-day yontif, a 30-day yontif.
So I'll refer back.
No, it's a fair question. I'll refer back to the story of Isomil that I mentioned a little while ago. The OU had a staff meeting at the time to discuss this question and ask what the rabbis who work for the OU kashrus what DE means. So you have two Jews, three opinions. We had 40 rabbis, 60 opinions. Right? Rabbi Ganak felt if the rabbis sitting in OU kashrus couldn't properly explain to themselves what DE means, how could we expect more of the consumer?
So you're telling me wouldn't be possible for the OU to identify those foods that could be eaten at a course other than one with meat?
No, the OU, I have on my computer a file, and the rabbi who answers the kashrus hotline actually has a whole database of products that are actually dairy equipment, but it's not something the OU is going to publish because this it's a fluid operation. Companies change and add dairy can add dairy at any time. And again, in 2037, you're still going to be assuming that the Oreos that I'm telling you tonight, the plain Oreos and only the double stuffed Oreos that are dairy equipment, are still going to be the same way. And who knows what, you know, who knows what's going to be in 3 months, 6 months, a year. Right, but the problem is the only thing that's going to change is maybe, you know, it's going to say whey protein powder in the ingredients, but it's still going to say the same OUD. And since there is a lot of confusion as to what dairy equipment really means, the OU feels that it's safer for the consumer and for Klal Yisrael not to have this DE designation. Right.
Like I have almond milk at home. It's got OUD on it, but there's an allergy warning. But it's like contains nuts, but it's completely free from milk. There's like no even allergy warning about milk.
Right, but it's probably produced, processed on the same equipment that that soy milk or regular milk is processed. And if you send an email to kosherq@ou.org or you call the Katras hotline 212-613-8207, I'm sure he will be happy to answer your questions. About any dairy product.
We cover convection ovens a little. What is the situation with convection ovens?
Many convection ovens in the industrial setting have an automatic shutoff. That when you open the oven, besides the fan going off, the oven, it's the element goes off as well, and because the newer convection ovens do not have pilot lights, the way it's set up, it's going to go down under 200 degrees very quickly, talking about 3 to 4 minutes from the time it opens. And if the non-Jewish chef closes the oven after it was open for a few minutes, then that cooking that's being done now in this convection oven is done by a non-Jew and is a problem of Bishalaka. It has to be, if it goes under 200, actually it's 176 degrees. If it's under 176 degrees and the non-Jew increases it above that temperature, that 176 degrees, I think, is what one of our poskim feels is the minimum possible temperature that something could be cooked at. We generally tell our place is 200 degrees to be safe, as we don't want to get, split hairs, which I have none of. On my face, not on my head.
What's the biggest near miss you've caught?
Biggest near miss? I take care of the restaurants and caterers. We had, nine restaurants open for Pesach this year. So, near misses, I was checking menus and being sure that there's no peas on the menu, making sure that the meat that comes in, is exactly like it's supposed to be. This is a fluid operation. These things go on all the time, and thank God, the secret ingredient in providing kosher certification is siyata deshmaya, is the help from heaven. And the day that we don't have that is the day we need to step aside from that. But Baruch Hashem, as long as we're acting for the sake of heaven and l'shem shamayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu watches out for us. Okay, let me just finish up with a couple of lines, and I'll wish everyone a good evening or a good night on my end. Right, Cy Sims always said an educated consumer is the best customer. Right, this evening and the entire lecture series was about trying to give from our knowledge to the communities outside of our immediate area and using technology to our advantage. So we tried tonight to give you a little bit of a knowledge of to know the questions to ask. Two, to not be afraid or ashamed to ask. Sometimes people call me and say, I hope you don't mind that I'm asking. I say, no, I'm happy you're asking, because when you ask, that forces us to be more on top of what's going on, and it enforces the restaurant. You know, sometimes people feel bad when they demand a certain level. And you know what? You know, when I first started working for the OU was when Milky Way and Three Musketeers and Snickers were getting an OU. And every Shabbos, I would come to shul Friday night, and I would be accosted by a few of my friends, and they would tell me, you know, when is it going to have the OU on it? Because we can't have it till the OU's on it. I said, you know, and I've updated this phrase to them because of modern social media. I used to tell them, when you and your 1 million closest friends, right, you can have a lot more friends today through other social media, but when you and your 1 million closest friends will contact the 800 number, then now the website of the company, wanting to order 10 cases, but you can only order it when it has an OU on it, you'll see how fast they send all those labels and product to a third world country and start making it with the product here. We underestimate our ability as consumers. Right? If we ask and we demand a certain standard, we can get a lot more than we think. Right? When one's invited to a simcha, call the caterer and ask the questions. Don't be afraid. It is our responsibility to be aware of what we are putting in our mouth. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. We are very fortunate to have available so much kosher food. Sometimes, you know, I go speak in schools and they ask me and they say, what, you know, can we get this to be kosher? Can we get this to be kosher? And we have to stop for a second and think and realize how fortunate we are that so many companies, that as much as we think and the world thinks that we own the entire world, we don't make up too much of the population of the world. And for big companies like Nabisco, we spoke about Oreos a lot tonight, like Coca-Cola and other, to put an OU on their product, to put a Hefsher on their product, is nothing short of a miracle. We have to appreciate what we have, but we also have to demand that our Hashgacha agencies keep to a high standard. And with that, I'm going to wish everyone a good night and a good Chodesh, and thank you for listening, and have a good night. Okay, if anyone has any further questions, Howie knows how to reach me. Take care. You too. Bye-bye.